stability. I don't know where he found the calmness. He saved us with his voice. Thus you can see that leadership depends partially on circumstance. Consider Winston Churchill, who was a great wartime leader of the British people, but who lost his first post-World War II election. One could diligently attend every single leadership training course offered in the United States without ever becoming a leader. I learned this from the Hebrew language, which doesn't even have a word for leader. The next section explains how Jews have viewed leadership. How Judaism defines leadership. Judaism has always been guided by the conviction that Hebrew is the Lord's language, and that it possesses a word for every reality in the world. Conversely, when you encounter an idea for which no Hebrew word exists, you are led to question the reality of that idea. Obviously, this does not apply to the natural sciences. The fact that no Hebrew word exists in the Torah for nuclear reactor casts no aspersions on the existence of atomic power. But for the basic areas of human life that have undergone little change through the eons of history, the absence of a word is grounds for suspicion. Take the word face, for which no Hebrew word exists in the singular. The language only offers a word for the plural faces, or in Hebrew, panim. Ancient Jewish wisdom regards this as a warning never to assume that any person only has one face. This means that every person is not only two-faced, but even three-faced or four-faced. This is not a derogatory accusation, but a statement of fact. Your face changes as you age and mature, and it begins eventually to reflect aspects of your character. Relatives and friends who have known you for years have come to see those different faces. Furthermore, different people in your life see different faces that you wear. Around the dinner table at home, your family sees one face, whereas an adversarial business acquaintance might well see quite a different face the next morning. It is in this spirit that one must question why Hebrew possesses no word for leadership. The language certainly has words for king, for ruler, and even for director, but no word for leader. Even Moses, surely the Old Testament figure who most readily leaps to mind when one thinks of leadership, was never thus described. One must distill the lesson from this absent word and see how it has influenced, perhaps subconsciously, the effectiveness of Jewish leaders throughout history. In Hebrew, the word for mother, aim, is followed alphabetically by the word for child, ben. This Hebrew peculiarity would be duplicated in English were the word child to be spelled not C-H-I-L-D, but N-P-N, following alphabetically, as it were, the word mom. This is, of course, not the case in English, but it is so in Hebrew. The A of aim is followed by the B of ben, and likewise the M of aim is followed alphabetically by the N of ben. This oddity, part of a Kabbalistic tradition, leads to the conclusion that no deep analysis is required to find out what a mother is. If a mother is followed by a child, that is to say she gives birth to or adopts a child, then she is a mother by definition. There is no way to become a mother other than by having a child. Similarly, there is no need to analyze what a leader is. A leader is someone who has followers. There is no way to be a leader other than by having followers. Becoming a leader. How do you become a leader? The answer is acquire followers. How do you acquire followers? First, acquire certain character traits, and then be willing to assume the responsibility of leadership by stepping into the role when circumstances bring that opportunity into your orbit of activities. Moses acquired the traits of leadership while living in the palace of Pharaoh. Later, God called him to leadership at the burning bush. At first, he demurred, explaining to the Lord why he was not the right choice. Discovering that you don't say no to God, he went on to lead the ancient Israelites out of Egypt. He came with the character traits. He came with an attractive vision for the future. And he acquired followers. There are no guarantees. Many people will acquire, or have already acquired, those character traits without ever becoming leaders. Others are thrust into leadership, or appointed to leadership, without ever having acquired these traits. And they fail dismally. What are these character traits? Learn to follow if you want to learn to lead. Maintain a clear vision of your goal. Confrontation is often necessary. Leadership requires mastery of both faith and facts. Learn to follow if you want to learn to lead. Learning to follow is, of course, counterintuitive. I would have thought that to become an effective leader, I needed to appear powerful and invincible. That surely means conveying to my subordinates the impression that nobody tells their leader what to do. Oddly enough, precisely the reverse is what works. You stand more chance of making it to leadership if you never miss an opportunity to point out to those around you that your actions are not simply spur-of-the-moment impulses, but the consequences of accountability to some external entity. Before people will follow a specific leader, they must first become viscerally persuaded on a subconscious level of the system of hierarchy. A leader depends on his or her followers accepting a sense of hierarchy in order to validate his or her leadership. Without some feeling that hierarchy as such is legitimate, the leader's entire leadership is in jeopardy. This was part of Adolf Hitler's downfall. The Nazis inculcated the Führer principle throughout the Third Reich. Führer means leader, and the idea was that every loyal German was to have an immediate leader. To young teenagers, the Führer principle meant that they obeyed the orders of the leader of their local Hitler Youth chapter. To the German Air Force officer, it meant that he followed the word of Hermann Göring, Chief Air Marshal of the Luftwaffe. It was easy to follow the chain of leadership upward, until one reached the ultimate leader, Hitler himself. The failure of the Führer principle was that the ultimate leader, Adolf Hitler, was not seen to have any leader himself. During the early stages of his leadership, he ruled by virtue of having pulled off breathtaking military successes. Later, as the tide turned against Germany, Hitler's leadership faltered because his decisions seemed to be capricious rather than in response to the orders of his ultimate authority. In contrast, Moses was one of the great leaders of ancient Israel, and he was accepted as a leader regardless of whether things were going well or not. This principle of a leader needing also to be a follower is even more important than technical leadership skills. For instance, everyone recognizes that a leader needs to be able to delegate. Yet, Moses was evidently a rather inadequate delegator. The Bible records how shocked his father-in-law Jethro was by the sight of Moses doing all the judging on his own. Moses' father-in-law said to him, "The thing that you do is not good. You will surely become worn out, for this work is too hard for you. You will not be able to do it alone." Moses took Jethro's advice and set up a management system of judges reporting to him. Although Moses obviously was not knowledgeable in this area of leadership, delegation, he nonetheless succeeded because he did possess the far more important quality of appearing to be a good follower. There were occasional minor rebellions against his leadership, but whenever God stepped in to help quell the uprisings, Moses' authority was even more firmly entrenched. Part of the reason that he was accepted as leader by millions of Jewish slaves was that he was seen to be a follower, just as much as a leader. He constantly made clear to his people that he was carrying out the words of God. The people themselves saw Moses punished whenever he deviated from such higher orders. The U.S. institution that has perhaps the finest system of leadership training is the military. Again, the leaders must be followers too, principle is at work. Even the most lowly ranked soldier knows that his commanding officer has his own commanding officer, and so on, all the way up to the President of the United States, who, in turn, owes allegiance to the Constitution of the United States. One secret behind each sergeant's leadership is that he is not merely an independent tyrant, embittering the lives of the soldiers beneath him, but he is a representative of a higher authority and answerable to that authority. A well-known directive found in the first chapter of Sayings of the Fathers, a well-loved volume of the Oral Torah, reminded Jews of the necessity of being a good follower. This section of the Mishnah, which is still often read in synagogues on Sabbath afternoon, reads, Yehoshua ben Parachia said, "Identify a rabbi as your rabbinic authority." This rule helped establish the idea that no Jew is an independent authority, but is instead bound to the traditions and rules of the past, and only through following them acquires the power to rule others. To this day, it is not uncommon to find conspicuously successful Jewish business leaders who defer many major decisions to an aged parent who was the original founder of the business. How to apply this leaders must be followers too principle in your own career can best be seen from the Torah model of how Jews believe the Jewish family was designed to operate. One way in which the traditional Jewish family benefits from this principle is the greater tendency of children in these more traditional families to obey parents and to observe their parents' values. They tend to accept their parents' authority because they are made very aware of the many areas in which their own parents follow authority also. Obeying parents only makes sense if the fundamental principle of obeying anyone else at all in the first place is supported. If the family vehicle sported a bumper sticker such as those that were in vogue during the 1970s, "Question authority," it would be difficult for parents to demand obedience from their children without becoming figures of derision. By contrast, children raised in traditional Jewish homes have ample opportunity to observe their parents upholding the principle of authority as they obey a wide swath of laws. The children are allowed to see how rules regulate how their mothers and fathers dress, eat, and even relate intimately. This evidence that parents follow a higher authority helps to validate the parents' authority with respect to their children. Parents are advised by Jewish tradition never to respond to the question, "Why are you doing that?" with merely a because I want to or because that's how it is. Instead, they commonly tell even their youngest children, because that is what God said I must do. In so doing, they are not weakening their parental authority. They are enhancing it. In your career, you can easily make use of this principle. You might not be in a situation in which you can claim to be obeying the authority of a board of directors. You might be an employer of a firm without a board of directors, or you might be the owner of a small private company. In neither case can you easily demonstrate that you are a follower, because, to all appearances as owner, you do whatever you wish. Fortunately, this principle works just as well when you declare yourself to be a follower of a set of principles. And this is something that anyone can do. Some organizations try to achieve this end with an honor code, or a mission statement. It is important that these not be trite, or even sound trite. Remember, you are trying to make it easier for people to follow your lead by showing that you subscribe to the leadership principle. You must find ways to demonstrate that you do not operate capriciously on the basis of whatever you happen to feel like doing. Therefore, you should seek opportunities in the presence of those you would lead to say things like, I would if I could, but my commitment or the company's commitment to this or that prevents me. In other words, do everything possible to avoid sounding like a big shot. For example, ambassadors derive considerable prestige and power by subordinating themselves to their governments. The ambassador's favorite phrase is, I will have to check with my government. On the surface, this would seem to diminish the diplomat. After all, where is his or her independent authority? Strangely, it does precisely the reverse. It endows the ambassador with additional authority. So, whether you credibly claim to be under the authority of another person or a group of persons, like a boss or a board, or whether you claim to be under the authority of a set of principles or rules that you regard as rigid, your leadership capacity benefits either way. Maintain a clear vision of your goal. During the early 1990s, the wounded giant IBM nearly collapsed. From having nearly 500,000 employees and a market capitalization larger than the gross domestic product of half the countries on the United Nations roster, IBM appeared ready for demise. Then, in early 1993, IBM's board appointed Lou Gerstner as CEO. His first public utterance as IBM chief was, "The last thing IBM needs right now is a vision." Since then, IBM went up fivefold, while the Dow during the same period merely tripled. Gerstner has done well by his shareholders, but according to Rich Karlgaard, Forbes magazine publisher, Gerstner lied. IBM did have a vision from 1993 to 2002. It was to become a master of new technology. IBM led the nation's companies in recording patents. It developed blue laser technology, speech recognition technology, optical microscopes, copper-wired microprocessors, and many other breakthroughs. People sometimes mock the vision thing, but everyone needs a vision. Someone intending to lead when the opportunity presents itself needs one, even more urgently. You must have a vision of your goal. More important, you have to know when to focus on your goal and when to focus on the intermediate steps. Suppose your project is to build a house. Should you focus on the overall design and how it will integrate with surrounding scenery, or should you focus on finding a supplier for the bricks? In other words, vision or details? What would someone who aspires to leadership do? Every Friday night, Jews sing a song welcoming the Sabbath by depicting the day as an approaching bride. One stanza concludes with these words about the creation of the Sabbath day. Last in deed, first in thought. The idea is that although God only created the Sabbath after he had already concluded his work during the first 6 days of creation, the Sabbath had been in his mind from the outset. This is why Hebrew affixes no names to the days of the week, preferring instead to refer to them as day one, day two, and so on. The idea is that if named, each day could be said to have its own existence as a disconnected and independent entity. However, by being numbered, each day exists only as a link to the sequence of numbers that concludes with number seven, the Sabbath. In other words, the purpose of Sunday, Monday, and so on is primarily to lead to Saturday, the Jewish Sabbath. In this way, God is not seen as having run out of steam on the sixth day and having nothing else left to create, deciding to declare the next day a Sabbath. Instead, the Sabbath is seen as an intrinsic part of the entire creation plan, although it was the last project in the creation. This tradition is kept alive by those words in the Sabbath welcome song, last indeed, first in thought. More important, those words were also a guide as to the proper time for ultimate vision, goal-oriented thinking. It should be last when you are engaged indeed, but first when you are engaged in thought. Do you remember that house? While designing it, think of its ultimate usage. Consider what it will look like up there on the hill. Should you include the existing trees in the final landscape? Now is the time to think about it. But soon the design phase will be complete and the blueprints drawn. Now it is time to begin grading the lot and digging foundations. At this deed phase of the project, contemplation of the final picture is merely daydreaming. Now there is work to be done, and that comes more easily when you focus on each step that lies ahead. Thus, the answer to the original question is that you should be able to focus on both the goal and on the intermediate steps. To begin a software design project or a business plan, you must focus on your ultimate goal. You must then break down that goal into intermediate phases, ensuring that each phase links seamlessly with those around it. Then, you need to break down each phase into specific tasks, each of which can be tackled without any distraction from the bigger picture. At regular intervals, you should glance up at the bigger picture to make certain that you are still on course. People are more liable to follow people who demonstrate that they know where they are headed, as well as knowing how to skirt or overcome the obstacles on the way. I cannot tell you exactly how to apply this principle in your life and in your career, but I can assure you that no matter what your occupation may be, there are opportunities to do so. Confrontation is often necessary. If you aspire to leadership, you must have the courage to persuasively present your vision. Even if you fail to carry the day, you are still ahead in leadership terms. Your vision may be a new marketing campaign, or it may be a vision of fairness and integrity. Naturally, you know how to confront productively, but no leader fears confrontation. I suspect that this important lesson crept into Jewish business culture from a famous biblical account of an incident in the life of Judah. Out of all 12 of Jacob's sons, Judah was the one who passed royal leadership down to his descendants. He was also the son whose name became the national identity of the Jews. This is more easily seen in the German word for a Jew, Jude, which was eventually contracted to Jew in English. 10 of Judah's brothers plotted to kill Joseph the dreamer. The eldest son, Reuben, suggested that instead of actually shedding blood themselves, they would do better to cast him into a pit where he would eventually die. Later, after they had done so, Judah approached his brothers with a plan to haul Joseph out of the pit and sell him to a passing band of merchants. It is believed that this was Judah's attempt to save his younger brother's life. A few verses later can be found the words, "And it was at that time that Judah descended from his brothers." Where did he descend to? And why use the word descend? Jewish tradition records the answer. Judah descended from his traditional position of leader. Deep inside their hearts, his brothers viewed him as having failed in leadership. Regretting the irreversible sale of Joseph, the brothers confronted Judah and blamed him for a failure of leadership. "Had you told us to return Joseph to his father rather than kill him or sell him, we would have listened to you." Judah felt himself diminished by their valid indictment, and the word descended accurately describes what happened to him. Apparently, Judah lacked the courage to confront his brothers with what he really wanted to say. "Look here, there is no way we can kill our brother. No matter how much we dislike him, we cannot hurt our father in this heartless fashion. I am not going along with this, and neither are you. Now haul him out of the pit and send him home." Instead, he aimed for a halfway measure and lost the respect of his brothers. He literally descended from them. Later, Judah recovers his leadership when Joseph, as viceroy of Egypt, threatens to keep Benjamin incarcerated. At that point in the narrative, it was Judah who stepped forward and explained to the feared Egyptian ruler that they simply could not go home without Benjamin. It was this display of courage, of fearless leadership, that moved Joseph deeply enough to reveal himself to his long-lost brothers. By facing confrontation, Judah recovered his leadership. The Enron debacle of fall 2001 revealed several instances of willingness to confront. One person who displayed little fear of confrontation was Sharon Watkins, a senior employee at Enron, who, during summer 2001, told Enron chairman and CEO Kenneth Lay that accounting irregularities would bring the company down. In what appears to have been a high-flying, risk-taking atmosphere, her lonely, cautionary voice would certainly not have been welcome. Nonetheless, she held her own and entered the pages of U.S. corporate history. Leadership requires mastery of both faith and facts. Some people master facts. If the facts they master pertain to the elasticity of polymers or the electrical resistance characteristics of semiconductors, those people tend to do well working as engineers. If the facts they master are legal precedents, they tend to succeed working for a law firm or for a law school. Other people who master the area of faith might find their niche as theologians. Those destined to succeed in leadership when the circumstance presents itself are those who have mastered both faith and fact. The latter is the easier to dispense with. Clearly, my confidence in my leader will be badly shaken if I find out that he or she is unaware of important and germane facts. This does not mean that my sergeant or my president must necessarily be an encyclopedia of facts. It does mean that the leader should be drawing on those who are in possession of the needed facts. He or she cannot risk appearing indifferent to facts relevant to the operation. For example, if an invasion is planned, I expect to be reassured by the leader's focus on intelligence. I want to see the leader assigning someone the job of finding out exactly what defensive capacity will be confronted. Similarly, if a new marketing campaign is being launched, I will more eagerly throw my efforts into the task if I know that the leader is aware of the competition. It is clear that your efforts to become a leader will be thwarted if you cannot master the relevant facts. Mastery of facts is an indispensable accompaniment to leadership, but it is only half the story. If facts are all you master, then you will always be valuable to the leaders, but you are not destined to become a leader yourself. The other necessary element is that of faith. Does this mean only religious people can become leaders? No, of course not. When I use the word faith with a capital F, I mean a special kind of faith, faith in Almighty God. However, when I use the word faith, I mean the ability to work as comfortably with something yet invisible as if it were already a present reality. Whether you are leading yourself or are already leading others, you are distinguished by something very important. You alone see the desired outcome in front of your very eyes as plainly as if it were already a reality. Abraham, the father of Judaism, effectively lived and taught this crucial point. As the first Jew, and also as the first Jewish father, he set the pattern of leadership for a father. Later, the Talmud codified it by saying, a father is obligated to do five things for his children. 1. He must first induct them into their socio-religious group, so that they will never feel culturally disconnected. 2. He must then instruct them in what he expects from them. 3. He must also assist them to marry. 4. He must teach them an occupation by means of which they can become useful to humanity and thereby earn their living. 5. And finally, he must teach them to swim. These five obligations rest on business leaders too. As a leader, 1. You must induct your employees into the culture of your organization. Without undergoing that acculturating experience, employees will never participate fully as members of a team. Without it, they will also fail to develop internal guidelines that will allow them to use their initiative in the absence of specific direction. 2. You must also be crystal clear on exactly what you expect from those who look to you for leadership. 3. You must also regard it as part of your mandate to ensure that no employee languishes in loneliness. 4. You must provide skill training that will allow each employee to contribute to the bottom line. 5. And finally, you must equip all your employees with the ability to remain afloat in turbulent waters. Returning to the story of Abraham, he reached the point where he felt obliged to find his son Isaac a wife. He dispatched his trusted servant Eliezer with these words, "Swear to me that you will never select a wife for my son from the Canaanites among whom I live." When Eliezer traveled back to Abraham's hometown of Nahor and finally picked Rebekah, he recounted the incident to Rebekah's family in these slightly modified words, And my master made me swear to him that I would not select a wife for his son from the daughters of the Canaanites in whose land I live. Tradition records that Eliezer subconsciously switched the words from "among whom I dwell" to "in whose land I live." That is the main difference between a leader and a follower. Abraham had been promised by God that the land was given to him. It was completely irrelevant that he was an isolated individual living among hordes of hostile Canaanites. To Abraham, they were now interlopers in his land. That was why he said that the Canaanites may be the people among whom he was living. But he was living among them in his own land. To Eliezer, the faithful follower, it was inconceivable that this was already Abraham's land. He lacked the faith to regard the invisible as an already existing reality. Eliezer felt that although God had promised the land to his master, it would become a reality when the transfer actually took place. To Abraham, the fact that God had promised him the land made it the present reality. He may be living among Canaanites, but he was doing so in his own land. But in recounting the story to Rebekah's family, Eliezer could not bring himself to utter the ridiculous words he had heard Abraham say, "among whom I live," thus implying to these strangers that he already regarded the land as belonging to his master. Thus, from the very start, Jews absorbed into their very beings the idea that you must act as if the desired outcome was already the reality. Before every single sales call, clearly see in your mind's eye the customer signing on the dotted line. In that way, you are magically transformed from a hopeful but apprehensive supplicant into someone merely formalizing something that is already a reality. That is what I mean by saying that faith is more important than facts. Obviously, you must know everything there is to know about your product and about how it will fill your customers' needs. That is necessary, but hardly sufficient. You also have to see the not yet completed transaction as clearly as if it were already a done deal. You are best understood and appraised by others on the basis of the things you believe rather than on the basis of the things you know. For example, during the 20th century, Jews again learned the importance of this principle. They learned that what the Germans of the Third Reich believed was far more important to guide to their actions than the things they knew. After all, Germany was a society whose universities had produced the world's most accomplished scientists, like Max Planck, and great philosophers, like George Hegel. Germany was a society that had produced writers like Heinrich Heine and musicians like Ludwig van Beethoven. Nevertheless, it was their beliefs about a super-race and the genetic inferiority of Jews, beliefs that had little to do with facts, that won the day and changed the course of history. Most of the really important adventures on which you embark depend on belief and faith. For instance, when you marry, you seldom do so on the basis of incontrovertible facts. You don't walk down the aisle knowing for certain that you are going to live happily ever after in a state of permanently wedded bliss. And you don't enter the state of matrimony knowing everything there is to know about your spouse. You marry on the basis of belief and faith. Paradoxically, the more certainty you attempt to inject into the situation, the less successful is the outcome. For instance, living together on a trial basis prior to making the marriage commitment ought to confer advantage, but it appears not to. After all, who would purchase a car without trying it out first, goes the old adage. Wrong. Buying a car is an action that can and should be based on total mastery of facts. You would be foolish to make a car-buying decision on the basis of falling in love with a particular brand's effective advertising and its seductive brochure. Before driving that shiny new vehicle out of the showroom, you should know everything there is to know about the car and the deal. But marriage is different. Statistics concerning the durability of marriage show that couples who lived together before marriage suffer a far higher divorce rate than those who did not. This is not really counterintuitive once one realizes that marriage is a faith-based activity. For an entrepreneur, starting a business far more closely resembles marriage than it does buying a car. Faith is a key. Using the power of prayer to enhance your faith and to improve your business success. How do people most effectively develop their faith muscle, as it were? Obviously, some are far better at this than others. However, there is no reason to leave it behind. Human beings can improve their ability to memorize poetry, to hold their breath underwater, and to run 5 miles, and they can also increase their abilities in the faith arena. Your effectiveness as a leader will have much to do with how much faith you exude about desired outcomes, and you can increase your ability to both feel and exude faith. An insight into how to increase your strength at faith can be gleaned from both religion and medicine. At Harvard Medical School, Dr. Herbert Benson, author of The Relaxation Response, found that psychological stress that impeded healing and that lowered immunity could be diminished by a simple prescription. Patients participating in the test were asked to utter a prayer, phrases, or other positive sounds repeatedly while simultaneously shutting out other thoughts. Isn't that a perfect description of prayer? When people pray, they repeatedly utter words and phrases that relate to a positive outlook about the future, while they shut out opposing thoughts. It is not surprising that many investigations, such as the Dartmouth Medical School study of 1995, have linked recovery to prayer. If you regularly participate in prayer, then you are already practiced in the technique. If not, then it will take just a little longer to overcome the self-consciousness that will tend to inhibit you. Dr. Benson at Harvard Medical School provided the clue. It simply is not adequate to merely think positive thoughts. Instead, you must also actually utter them. I recognize that it isn't easy to speak out loud when nobody else is present. Initially, doing so will cause you to nervously glance at the door, perhaps expecting white-coated attendants to barge in at any moment to take you to the nearest mental hospital. After all, people tend to distrust those who wander city streets talking to themselves. That is why I would recommend that you practice this technique when alone. You will not necessarily find it easy. I don't think most people are comfortable following the talking out loud advice I'm about to dispense. This is perhaps why prayer is most easily achieved in a congregation of many others doing the same thing. You might feel a little less self-conscious praying in company. Through prayer, you have the capacity to bring about powerful consequences, but only if you actually utter the words loudly enough for your own ears to hear. Here's another idea of how to expand the lessons of verbal prayer to the rest of your life. You might respond to this suggestion with incredulity, but I recommend that you try it for a few weeks rather than allowing your skepticism to prevent you from undergoing a possibly exciting and profitable experience. My suggestion is quite simple. Early in each day, find a quiet opportunity to say out loud an affirmation of faith having to do with your business challenge. It need not be lengthy, but you should state it explicitly, and it should reflect your conviction in what you intend to achieve. For example, if your professional goal is to increase revenue during the coming month, do not merely say out loud to yourself, "I know I can sign up more clients this month, and that is exactly what I'm going to do." Instead, be more specific and think about what has hitherto obstructed your path to greater revenue. Have you failed to line up sufficient meetings with prospects? Have you met with prospects but failed to persuade a sufficient number to give your services a try? Identify as precisely as possible the exact areas in which you intend to improve. Make certain that you are not being handicapped by any lack of technical skills or inadequate knowledge. Once you are certain that you are equipped for success, and that you know where you intend applying your energies, you are ready to commence your program. Dr. Benson might call it repeated uttering out loud of phrases and sentences that describe you succeeding, while simultaneously shutting out any negative thoughts. Now write down your specific goals. This is important. By writing them down, you will not be distracted by concerns over what to say next. Furthermore, you will benefit from using the same terminology repeatedly. That is why so much of prayer is formalized and standardized text. This process should take about 2 or 3 minutes a day. Don't rush it. Do it where you need not fear being overheard by someone. Say your affirmation loudly enough for your own ears to hear, and do it regularly for a period of at least 2 weeks before you dismiss it as ineffective. If you follow these instructions diligently, you will be pleasantly surprised. Here's an analogy. Musical advertising jingles do not constitute great symphonic music, but they do add considerable value to radio and television advertising because the music makes the commercial more memorable and adds emotional wallop to the message. The simple tunes do not convey the lofty aspirations of the human soul that are found in a Beethoven symphony, but they effectively utilize some of the power of music. Only a cultural snob would frown on the commercial usage of music and its ability to penetrate the soul. Similarly, what I have just described to you borrows microscopic morsels from the infinite power of prayer and deploys those morsels to great effect. Obviously, this does not replace prayer, or even resemble it in any meaningful way. Yet this process bears exactly the same relationship to prayer as advertising jingles do to Beethoven's Symphony Eroica. Remember, advertising jingles work, and so does this. Finally, consider this. What do you have to lose by trying? Skepticism is natural, and I would be surprised if you felt none. Everyone has been somewhat conditioned to think of humans as very little more than $6 worth of common chemicals. So how can talking to yourself possibly do anything for you other than getting you committed to a not particularly choosy asylum for the disturbed? If you are absolutely sure that this is the sum total of a human, then there is little more for me to say. But if you have come to suspect that humans are creatures whose domination of the world has more to do with their spiritual side than with the mass of their brains, then this idea should make some sense to you. Maintaining balance. One of the dilemmas of leading is finding the balance between two competing and often incompatible demands. Suppose a military leader has orders to take an objective regardless of casualties, And this military leader knows that part of what makes him a leader is his deep concern for each and every warrior under his command. For example, whenever he became aware of Allied losses during World War II, Winston Churchill was unable to conceal from those around him the grief that welled up inside him. When Turing bombed out homes in London during the Blitz, Churchill was met by brave homeowners standing astride the ruins of their former homes, and he wept openly. Similarly, any leader, whether military or corporate, needs to view those under her command simultaneously as both pieces in the overall puzzle and as unique and all-important human beings. Jewish tradition is not baffled by an apparent indecisiveness that God has about Abraham's descendants. Sometimes he assures the patriarch that his children will be as many as the sand of the seashore. And at other times he predicts them to grow to be as many as the stars of the heavens. Why doesn't God stick with one metaphor? The traditional answer teaches a valuable business lesson in leadership. There is one key difference between grains of sand and stars. The former only have significance in concert with countless other similar grains of sand. Together, they can form a dike and hold back the seas, but alone, each grain gets swept away. A star, on the other hand, stands alone in its brilliance and significance. God wants Abraham to learn to view his people in these two conflicting ways at the same time. Are you expected to cope with two conflicting ideas simultaneously? Yes. If you want to lead, you must. This is where the Oral Torah teaches this lesson to Jews. A translation of the Bible's first chapter, Genesis, would quickly reveal that the first commodity created by God was light. The oral transmission asked the question, why should light have been first? Why not water, or people, or air? It was the oral transmission that explained the answer in terms that would much later become familiar to 20th century theoretical physics. The creation of the world was the original conversion of mind to matter. Things came into existence, apparently, not in a workshop, but merely as the result of God thinking and speaking. No commodity more than light so obviously bridges that gap between ideas and reality. After all, light possesses an almost inexplicable duality. On the one hand, a light beam behaves with perfect predictability, as if it were a stream of tiny tennis balls called photons. The flashlight emitting the light beam even gives an immeasurably small recoil when one turns it on, just as would a tennis training machine as it commences firing its tennis balls at a waiting player on the tennis court. On the other hand, light is nothing more than advancing wave fronts of intangible information, with the capacity to interfere with one another. Well, which is it? Is light a stream of tiny particles with mass and presence, no matter how small? Or is light intangible information and data? It cannot be both, yet it is both. Light is the interface of data and matter. It is the one thing that God would have had to start with if his mind was to bring matter into being from nothingness. Light is the original bridge from mere thought into real matter, and nothing else could serve this role any better. As challenging as it may be, light serves as a reminder that for a leader to change a reality, he or she must nearly always cope with conflicting ideas and even conflicting demands. Not everyone can do it. Not everyone wants to make the effort to learn how. leaders do. Maintain employee individuality. Nowhere is the challenge of incomparable demands more difficult than in human relationships. Whether in dealing with employees, shareholders, family members, or even yourself, you frequently have to walk the line between two incompatible desires. Sometimes you have to choose one or the other alternative. At other times, you can express your ambivalence in word and thought, even though in action only one course can be tolerated. You need to recognize that on an exquisitely spiritual plane, two apparently incompatible entities can usually be welded into one luminescent harmony. Just as particles and waves constitute light even though they should not be able to do so, viewing a person simultaneously as part of a larger mission and as an indispensable human like no other can constitute the highest form of leadership. In ancient Israel, Jewish kings were prohibited from counting the people of Israel. Whenever a census was necessary, stratagems were contrived to avoid actual counting of the population. What lay behind this prejudice against counting? The whole point of counting a lot of objects is that in doing so, you are implying that they are all identical. You wouldn't count dollars, pesos, liras, and pounds and end up with one total currency figure. Were a king to count his people by conventional census, he would be accustoming himself to view them as a faceless crowd of anonymous and identical beings whose purpose is merely to serve him. No leader who becomes known for viewing his or her subjects or subordinates this way will survive for long. It is true that on one level, the employees of an organization are there to fulfill the purpose of the organization. It is also true that cross-training is recommended, and manuals are created in order to make the position indispensable, rather than making any one occupant of the position indispensable. Ideally, it would be wonderful to have an organization structured not to miss a beat if anyone, or even all of the employees, walked out the door and were replaced the next day by new people. In reality, of course, that could never work. Even with the best operating manuals, organization charts, and management structure, any organization still depends on the subtle human network of accumulated knowledge, culture, and skills within all its people, which makes it behave more like a single interconnected organism than like a hotel filled with disconnected guests staying the night. This is obviously true for a software development company in which virtually all its assets, namely its people, leave every evening to go home. Were an entirely different set of people to show up the next morning, the company would clearly be in turmoil. Any observer lacking the understanding that the commercial enterprise is at its heart, a spiritual one, would argue, "Wait a moment. These people look just like those who left last night. There is the same number of men and women, blacks and whites. They all have the same backgrounds and training as your former employees. What do you mean the company can't operate?" It is also true for a manufacturing enterprise, in which most of the company's assets are its machinery and factory infrastructure. Still, the company depends on the relationships that its employees have built up between one another and on the trust between them. Replacing them all overnight would be a very perilous undertaking. The wise leader recognizes this dichotomy between nobody is indispensable and everybody is indispensable. Of course, businesses try to organize their enterprises around functions rather than around personalities. Whether you are setting up a workstation along a computer assembly line or a customer service phone desk, you know exactly what function needs to be performed at that point. You then ask the personality to adjust himself or herself to the needed function. However, you never lose sight of the personality. Wise leaders do their best not only to get to know the personality, but also to make certain that the personality realizes that, to the leader, he or she is more than merely a function. When Hitler assumed personal command of the German army on December 22, 1941, his words were,